Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
We continue this week with our Protestant Reformation series devoted to exploring the various facets of the historic change that a certain monk and professor started 500 years ago after nailing an intellectual protest and challenge to the Catholic Church on the door of a church in a small German town. And with keeping with our podcast tradition of featuring lesser-known scholars who might otherwise not get a voice, I am pleased to feature a very special guest today, Robert Sorensen, a graduate of Western Washington University, go Vikings, and a PhD candidate in political philosophy at Faulkner University in Montgomery, Alabama, working under the tutelage of Professor Jason Jewell, a previous guest on our podcast. Rob is writing a dissertation entitled Christopher Dawson and the Protestant Reformation. It is not just the connection with Jason Jewell that I've come to learn about Mr. Sorensen, but through his teaching at the Bear Creek School in Redmond, Washington, where our son happens to be a senior in high school. Go Grizzlies! It is truly a small world. Rob is not only a teacher of world history and Western civilization at the Bear Creek School, but he has also written a book entitled Martin Luther and the German Reformation, a text in the Perspectives in History series from Anthem Press. This is a highly readable and pithy text that is a perfect introduction to anybody who is interested in the life, times, and influence of Martin Luther. We will link to it on our website along with previous episodes in the Protestant Reformation series. Sign up with us on Facebook and Twitter to see what other goodies we have coming up. Rob, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
Now, it's pretty rare for a PhD candidate and a high school instructor to write a scholarly book, let alone on a topic as big as Martin Luther's life. So this is really cool. Tell us how you became interested in the topic of the Protestant Reformation, Martin Luther, and then how did you end up writing a book in this Anthem Perspectives in History series?
Well, yeah, so it was, I kind of stumbled into it, to be frank. I've been a high school teacher for 17 years, and I've always kind of had what do you call it, scholarly pretensions. I came here out of a master's program in Texas, and I've always kind of wanted to pursue higher things. And so I got into this PhD program at Faulkner. And the book, it kind of came out of I was on a mailing list, email mailing list with other high school teachers, and Anthem sent out this call for contributions for the series. And the series is kind of aimed at high school students and college undergraduates. And not counting the cost, I said, hey, I could write a book, sure. So I sent out the proposal, and they accepted it, and then I had to write the darn thing.
Yeah.
So I kind of just stumbled into it without really knowing what I was getting into. And it took me a couple of years to get it written. But I'm pretty pleased with having done it. I don't remember who said this, but I'm not sure I like writing books, but I do like having written a book. So it's nice to have it out there.
Yeah, I from my own perspective, too, writing is one of the hardest things in academia to do. But what about the topic here, Martin Luther? As my son has noted, you're a big, huge Martin Luther fan. Where did this all start, your interest in the Protestant Reformation and such?
I am. I'm a big fan of Luther. And I have been for a long time, which is why that was the topic that I sort of pitched to Anthem when they said, hey, we've got this series. So I am... For many years, for most of my life, I have been a Lutheran, and I just have been I've been a fan of Luther for a lot of his theological position, right? His idea that we're saved by grace, not by things that we do, I think is a really important thing in my own spiritual development. I want to think that I've earned my place. You know, I want to be the guy, you know, when I want to get the glory for it. And what Luther points out is, well, we don't, we can't. And I found that super comforting. And also, I think Luther as a man of the 16th century, as someone who is more well documented than almost anyone else in the 16th century. I mean, we know about Luther's family life. We know about what he ate for dinner. We know about the kinds of personal quarrels he had. There's so much interesting stuff about him out there. And so as a human being, I'm interested in him. And I also admire him theologically as a person after whom I could model my own spiritual life.
Now, you mentioned that there's a lot of documentation on Martin Luther that's out there, and you have to pile through all of this, and it's probably impossible for anybody to get through everything in just a lifetime. But you mentioned something here that he writes down what he has for dinner. What was his typical dinner? I'm just curious about this. I mean, historical figures, we don't think they're so brilliant that they don't eat or have to do anything like walk the dog less normal people do, but they do.
Absolutely. Well, he... At the end of his life, when he was well-known and had some means, he enjoyed, good food. He had a lot of fish. He really enjoyed his wife's cooking. So one of the things that comes in his letters to his wife when he's off traveling is he says, well, I really miss your cooking, right? The food here, and especially the beer here, it just doesn't hold up to what I have at home. And he had some health concerns in his life that were related to his sort of overindulgence in things like red meat and beer. So
yeah, we get pictures of Martin Luther later in his life as a pretty chunky dude. And obviously the love of beer goes into that, which makes him one of my favorite characters. But earlier in his life, too, if you see some early pictures of him, he's actually pretty svelte. And I know there's certain times in his life where he denied himself a lot of food and beverage and that as a means of penance. We're going to get to that. But let's investigate this guy who eventually ends up eating well and drinking lots of beer by going all the way back to his early childhood to find out who Luther the man is. And this might actually take us back to some of his family's history as well, his parents and possibly some of his grandparents. So go ahead and start us off with who were his parents and what was his early childhood like?
Yeah, so Luther was born into, he made a big deal about being a peasant later in life. That was his claim. He wanted to claim solidarity with the lower classes and the poorer people. And that's true to an extent. He was from a farming background. His grandfather, his paternal grandfather, had been a farmer, although a farmer of some means. He had an inheritance that he could hand on to his kids. Luther's own father was a miner. He worked in the tin mining industry, and ultimately worked his way up to become more of a supervisor, a manager of mines. And so Luther would, from our perspective, probably have grown up in what would have been relatively comfortable middle class. Now, they don't have the same kind of social safety net as we did, so there was always that chance of dire poverty. And Luther certainly knew some want as a child. But the family sent him to school, which was not a regular thing for young men. That required a fair bit of means. And it seems pretty clear that his mother's family was pretty solidly middle class and included professionals like physicians in there. And they probably supported sending the young Martin off to school. So I think it's fair to say that Luther was middle class in his growing up.
It is very interesting. We talk about the peasant background, and whenever we say peasant, the image always comes up of a serf on a feudal estate and ragged clothes, hoeing the soil. But that's not the case here. You mentioned his dad was a miner, and you oftentimes have to think, well, they needed metal, so somebody had to do the mining, and there was a lot of it around. So very interesting that he emphasized the peasant nature of his background. Is there any particular reason why you think he might have emphasized the fact that he was a peasant rather than one of these, I don't know, what we would call today middle-class managers, families types?
Yeah, I think it was important for Luther to present himself as being not an elite. I think he wanted to make sure that people understood that he came to his position not because he was given something by inheritance and not because he was well connected. I think he would have said he came to prominence because of the grace of God. But I think the peasant story has a lot more to do with wanting to emphasize that he was not privileged, rather than to say that he came from a destitution of some sort.
So tell us about his early childhood, or what we know of it. How was his father and mother and raising him, and what did he do as a, I don't know, say a kid under 10 years old?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of what we know about that is from his recollections much later in life. And so it's hard to know how much of that is colored by his later experiences. It does seem that his parents were relatively strict with him, and he talks a couple of times about how his there was physical punishment in the household. I'm not certain that that's atypical for a 16th century household. There's some scholarship, it goes back to Erik Erikson in, I think, the 50s was when he wrote, that suggests that some of Luther's problems with the church stem from his problems with his father. And I'm not certain how much stock I put in that, because it does seem that father and son reconciled as adults. His father was present at his first mass, and they wrote amicable letters to one another as adults. But it does seem like Luther grew up in a household where the father figure was strict, and where he was expected to respect and obey. And that may have contributed to some of his seeing the Pope as a strict father-like figure.
Now, one of the things I didn't know about his name, and reading your book actually enlightened me to this, his name comes from where? How do you get the name Martin? They just randomly pick something out, or where did it come from?
Yeah, well, I think he's named after St. Martin of Tours, because he was born on the feast day of St. Martin of Tours. I think that was the typical custom, or perhaps I should say atypical custom, to name the child after after the saint on whose name day he was born. I don't know of any family members that were named Martin in his ancestry, so I think that's the way he got that name.
So it seems that he's coming from a religious family, or at least one that's steeped in a religious culture around here, that he gets the name Saint Martin. How about his education? Did he have a theological education growing up? You mentioned that it's not typical for a peasant to actually send their kids to school, but he goes to school at an early age. What is he studying? What is he learning?
Yeah, I think every education in the 16th century would have been to some extent a religious education. That was the core of the curriculum. Luther was in the intention of having him sent to school was to study law and to become a counselor or a lawyer, a professional. That would have been something that a young man in his condition would have been able to aspire to be an attorney. So he wasn't looking at the ministry initially. I mean, his kind of turn into becoming a monk was unexpected, unplanned. So he would have studied the liberal arts. He would have started by studying grammar and dialectic and public speaking and those sorts of things. And so he went to a grammar school, and then ultimately went to the university at Erfurt studying the liberal arts. And then he began law school, but then, as we'll see, he doesn't complete law school, because he sort of shifts gears and goes into being a monk.
Yeah, those rebellious kids. You send them off to law school, and then they end up doing something else.
I know. And his father was apparently quite unhappy about he's like, we spent all this money to send you to school, and now you're giving away all your stuff and becoming a monk.
It's not only that, too. You mentioned in the book he studied at Eisenach. That's kind of the middle part of his education. He finishes what you would consider grammar school. And then he develops an interesting interest in his schooling. What was that?
Yeah, well, he does enjoy music, and one of the fascinating things about Luther is that he is he's a very musical person. One of his lasting impacts on the church is introducing a lot more singing and a lot more congregational participation in the music in church. Luther was apparently an accomplished musician. He played the lute. He sang. He would lead his family in singing, and apparently he would hold congregational music practices between Sunday services so that the congregation would be able to sing appropriately during the church service. So And of course, he wrote hymns. We all know A Mighty Fortress, but he wrote dozens and dozens of hymns.
Yeah, possibly the start of the ubiquitous choir practice on Tuesday evenings, right?
That is correct.
That creates so much conflict in many congregations, but he plays the lute and all this stuff. And I can imagine his father as well, sending him off to law school and say, what are you studying? Well, I love music and poetry. You know, every parent that sends their kid off to college to study law, that's the big nightmare. He does go to University of Erfurt in 1501, and what is going on there? I'm sure he struggled with his studies because a peasant kid studying at a university has got to be pretty tough, right?
Yeah, I think he was a fairly good student. Not the top of his class, but not the bottom either. He was, Erfurt was one of the newer universities in Germany, and it was a place where the new sort of style of learning was taught, and so he was well versed in nominalism, which was relatively new at that point. That's kind of the intellectual tradition that was going on there at Erfurt.
Explain that a little bit too. I have to back up a second. When I was asking you the question, I was a little bit facetious in how difficult it was for him to be at university. He finished in 1 year, right?
Yeah.
That's pretty quick.
It is. I don't know if that's typical, but he was a good student. I think his problem at the university was he was super introspective. He was brilliant, but like some students, he wasn't really satisfied with himself, and he was always sort of second guessing his own scholarship, I suppose. So that,
yeah, that's going to play later into some of his decisions to go into the seminary. But at Erfurt, you said there was this new style of learning. Explain what that means, and you also threw in this term nominalism. What is? I have no idea what that is.
Yeah, so nominalism is a new, I guess, philosophical position that was growing in the universities at the time, and it's contrasted to realism. And the nominalists suggested that the essences of things are not real existing things, right? Like Plato says, the reason that we can know that dogs are dogs and chairs are chairs is because there's this real thing, this capital C chair, this capital D dog that's out there. And the nominalists, their philosophical position starts with, well, those are conventions. Those names are conventional things. They're names, nomina. And that's where it comes from. I think what's important for Luther about the nominalists is the nominalists emphasize, at least under a guy like William of Ockham, the power of God, right? God is not bound by sort of moral laws. Rather, God sort of creates moral laws by the act of his sovereign will, which creates a situation in which God is dramatically separated from humanity, right? Because there's no sort of moral framework out there that is accessible to human beings and God. It's rather the sovereign God and humanity, and that contributes to Luther's sort of unease. I think this idea that God is ultimately sovereign, and there's no real way for me to access God, or to access a God that I can love.
Mm-hmm. So this creates a lot of self-doubt, as you say, introspection within the young Luther, the university-age Luther. He's going there in 1501, so he's about 18, 19 years old or so,
yeah,
around this time. And I have to note, you mentioned William of Ockham, right? Is, yeah, a big nominalist figure. Is that the guy from Ockham's Razor?
It is, Ockham's Razor. Yeah, everybody knows Ockham's Razor.
Yeah. Yeah, no, he's a theologian and also an inspiration for a lot of scientific inquiry.
Yeah.
And this is what's happening to Luther at this time. He's really interested. He's a studious character, but very introspective and filled with a lot of self-doubt. What is happening to him spiritually, intellectually during this time that leads him onto the path that he eventually will take?
Yeah, I think one of the things that Luther is concerned about is, how can I know that I am saved, right? How can I know that God loves me? How can I know that God will accept me? And one of the traditional, I shouldn't say traditional, one of the ways that the economy of salvation was presented in Luther's schooling was something like this. you can't please God of your own efforts, right? And so God will save you by grace, but God expects you to do your best. God expects you to do as much as you possibly can. And then once you've done as much as you possibly can, God's going to fill in the rest and all that. And Luther, who is quite intelligent on this, says, okay, if I grant that, how can I know that I've done my very best? Because he says, well, I look at myself and there's always more I could have done, right? I mean, I always could have, you know, instead of going to the theater, I could have spent that time praying, right? There's always that I could have done more. And so he's worried that he didn't do his best. And God's going to say, ah, you know what? You did some, but you didn't really do your best, so I'm going to withhold my grace. And then it's also the question of motive, right? His teacher said, well, you know, to do good, you have to do good because you love God and you intend to do good. And Luther says to himself, and he recognizes, well, a lot of times I do good because I fear judgment, right? You know, the reason I don't take that cookie out of the cookie jar is not because I'm honest and a good person. It's because I don't want the punishment, right? And he says, well, that doesn't get me any grace with God. So he spends a lot of time in his head going through this neurosis about, have I done enough? Have my motives been pure? And of course, as you know, when we think through that, you can never get mm-hmm. to perfection that way. There's always room for error. So that just drove him nuts.
Yeah, you get into one of these vicious cycles of, are my motives pure? And then you try to analyze that, but then you start to analyze your analysis of, if is me thinking about whether my motives are being pure, an essence or an example of them being pure, right?
You know? That's right. Okay, you can just lull yourself into insanity.
Oh, I can imagine how that would occur. So this is rolling around in his brain, kind of racking his conscience quite a bit. And he is on, as we mentioned earlier, a secular education path. And secular not meaning that there's no religion involved in it, but he's on his way to becoming a lawyer or a professional. But he becomes a monk. He takes a detour somewhere. Is there anything that prompts him to do this?
Yeah, the famous story is, and he tells the story himself after the fact, that he is he's returning to law school after he's gone home for a break, after his first year of law school. And as he's walking back to school, there's a massive thunderstorm. And thunderstorms in the 16th century, when people don't have sort of, you know, climate control indoors and stuff, were pretty scary. And a bolt of lightning struck the ground near him, knocked him down, scared the bejeebers out of him. And he said one of those prayers that we all say in those times of crisis. And he says, well, save me. He didn't pray to God. He prayed to Saint Anne, the patron saint of miners, because he was still a little nervous about God being this kind of distant deity. And so he prays, save me, save my life. And if you save my life, I'll become a monk. He makes that promise, right, rashly. And I've done that too, right? Mm-hmm. You know, oh, let me pass this test I didn't study for, and then I'll never fight with my brother again, right? But most of us, once we're done, right, oh boy, thanks God. And oh, that promise I made, I didn't really, you're not gonna hold me to that,
yeah,
really.
Yeah.
But one of the fascinating things with Luther is he does it. And I think that tells me that he was pretty serious about thinking through his religious trajectory even before this, right? That he came out of this lightning storm. He's like, yeah, I'm pretty serious. I'm going to take this vow seriously.
One, I'm always skeptical of psychological retrospection on historical figures, but one could almost imagine that rolling around in his head with all this nominalism and discussion about grace and what it means to be saved and how you can connect with God, he probably was already pump primed to be a monk, even though his family pressure was pushing him in a different direction. He just needed something, you know,
yeah, I
something
think that's
to
absolutely
push
true.
That button, right?
Yeah.
And he could go back to Dad and say, well, Dad, you know, I made a promise with God here about the lightning storm. I got to do it.
Yeah. You know what his dad said? He actually said that to his father. And his father was, are you sure it was God and not the devil? Mm. And of course, that threw Luther into more sort of neurosis there. And his father also reminded him, he says, well, you reminded him of the commandment. Well, you got to honor your father and mother. Are you honoring me by doing this? And so he just kind of dug the knife in just a little bit deeper for poor Luther there. So.
Oh, what a way to put your college-age kid into a bind, right? He's like, yeah, I promise God this, and then, but God says honor your mother and father, and your mother and father don't want you to do what you just said to God. And you're like, I can imagine. But he does end up going into the seminary, monastery, I should say.
Yeah, I suppose technically he is a canon regular of the Order of St. Augustine. Colloquially, I think monk is okay.
Well, what does that mean, canon regular of St. Augustine?
Yeah, so he's a member of the Order of St. Augustine, which was a monastic order, and it was a mendicant order, which makes him not technically a monk but a friar, I suppose. So they would beg for their living. But the Augustinians were. I think he chose the Augustinians because they were fairly strict, and Luther thought that he needed that kind of strict discipline in order to kind of purge himself of those things that he thought were standing in his way of God, of being in his way with God. But he also chose the Augustinians because they were the scholarly monks. They were the ones that staffed the universities, and Luther was always an intellectual. And so I think some of the Augustinian canons would have been his teachers, at Erfurt, and so he knew them and respected them. But that strict observance was important to him too, because he still kind of felt like if he could do enough, right? I mean, he's still got that mindset that says, I have to do my very utmost. I have to reach this point before God's going to step in with his grace. And he's trying to do everything he can to reach that point where God's going to step in.
Now, for a lot of us today, doing our utmost means getting out of bed early Sunday morning and getting to church in the pews and occasionally singing. Luther takes doing his utmost to some pretty extreme levels. How did he try to prove his worthiness to God?
Yeah, he said, if ever a monk could have earned heaven by his monkishness, it was me. That's what he says of himself later in his life. And he worked super hard. The other monks, I think, probably saw him as that kid that ruins the curve on the test, right? What you got to work so hard for, Brother Martin, right? You're making the rest of us look kind of lame. My favorite story of this is he used to spend tons and tons of time in confession. Because it was important to confess your sins, because you couldn't have your sins. You couldn't reconcile yourself with God without confessing and doing penance for your sins. And so he would go to confession for hours and hours and hours, trying to confess every little sin, everything he could think of. And apparently his sins weren't particularly interesting. I mean, it's not like he went to Reno and killed a man just to watch him die, right? He committed all these little sins. And his confessor, a guy named Johann Staupitz, who was to become an important figure in Luther's adult life, Staupitz would listen to these things. And you can imagine he's getting bored and, you know, yawning after, you know, 90 minutes of Luther confessing his things. And Luther reports that at one point Staupitz assigned him as his penance. He says, well, your penance for all this is you have to go out and commit a real sin so you can confess something interesting to me the next time. And I suspect this is kind of rhetorical flourish on Staupitz's part. But it emphasized to Luther that, you know, you're confessing and confessing and confessing, but this isn't really the depth of perdition that you think it is.
Yeah, again, one of these intellectual spirals you can get into. You do so much confessing that you spend so much time confessing, not doing good works, that you feel like your confessions are in and of itself a sin or something like that.
Yeah.
I can imagine how that... I mean, this guy's a hardcore introspective thinker, as we're learning as well.
He is, yeah.
Health-wise, he had a lot of illnesses, too, and I'm wondering if that contributed to some of his, I don't know, self-angst or something like that.
Yeah, he was a man who was physically ill for much of his life, and some of it probably has to do with the deprivations that he endured as a monk. So living as a monk for 15 years with a lot of self-denial probably took a toll on his body. So he suffered from heart conditions and from gallstones for much of his adult life. And he also suffered from what he called Anfechtung, which is one of those great German words that is hard to really precisely translate. What he means by it is this kind of despair in the soul. And he talks a lot about that, how he was beset by these things and how they made him despair of life, right? And that if anyone had experienced even 10% of what I experienced, they would want to kill themselves, right? I mean, you had this kind of high sense of that. And that's what leads some modern scholars to wonder if Luther struggled with mental illness as well as physical illness, because sometimes that kind of thing can be evidence of that. I'm a little nervous about psychoanalyzing Luther 500 years after the fact. I think it makes it too easy for us to read our own modern sensibilities into Luther. But he certainly was troubled by health concerns of various sorts that are both sort of causes and effects of his asceticism, I think.
Yeah, as we mentioned earlier in our interview here, we picture the later Luther in pictures where he's rather rotund, but he was denying himself food for days and on end as part of his penance. And he's also, as you say, a mendicant monk or a friar responsible for actually ministering to populations. So he, at a certain point in time, he gets to say his first mass. What happens here? This is an interesting story.
So he's ordained as a priest, right? Not every monk is a priest, but Luther was chosen to be ordained as a priest. He actually was as a parenthetical, he was fairly successful as a monk. I mean, he says that he was an observant monk, but you know, he was promoted. He became a priest, which was not something every monk did. He spends a lot of time on sort of monastic business. He was a vicar, which puts him in a supervisory position over some other monks. And so he was fairly successful. At the time of his first mass, this was the first time his father had visited him in person at the monastic house where he was at. And this caused him to be really, really nervous about the mass. And he actually spilled the wine, which was a big no-no, because that's God's blood, right? That's Christ's blood. You don't want to disrespect that. And that's one of the reasons that it was not customary to give the wine to the laity, because you don't want to accidentally, dribble God down your chin, right, or backwash into Jesus' blood or something. So he was really nervous, and it caused a little bit of a spat between him and his father. Although his father, the occasion of his coming was to celebrate this great event, and he brought a big gift. I don't remember what the gift was for it was 30 gold coins or something, some very generous gift to the monastery. So there's a background where his father was there to be kind of generous, but Luther was really nervous about it.
And I can kind of see this as you have a strict father, you've taken the path that your father didn't want you to take. All of a sudden he shows up. Oh, how, you know, what's going on in his head? What's going on in my head? This guy is super introspective. So that's just going to be a scene. One would wish that we had video back there and just to kind of see what happens with that.
That's true.
So he does ministering, and I can imagine he's a great pastor because he's organizing hymns, bringing more music into church, which I always think is a great thing. But he eventually makes his way to the university, specifically Wittenberg University. So tell us how he gets there, and tell us a little bit also about Wittenberg University.
Yeah, Luther takes a doctorate in theology and Bible, more or less, at the orders of his university. It's actually Staupitz that does that to him, that does it to him, imposes his doctorate upon him. So Staupitz says, your assignment is to get a doctorate and become a college professor. And he thought it was going to be at Erfurt. That's where he was stationed initially. And he is eventually transferred to Wittenberg, which is a small, new university. It's really out in the sticks, right? I mean, it would be like it was in Duval or something. Wittenberg was founded by the Elector of Saxony. There was this political split in Saxony. So the big Saxon university was in the other guy's territory. And so the electoral family of Saxony wanted their own university. So they set up Wittenberg as this kind of rival university. And Staupitz was one of the leaders of that university, and he ultimately assigned Luther to become this professor at Wittenberg. And Luther was probably not super happy with that. I mean, Erfurt was an established school, and it was kind of, urban. I mean, there was some stuff there. And But Wittenberg was out in the sticks, and there was nothing much there. And so that's where he went as a professor. That's where he would live for the rest of his life. And Luther more or less establishes Wittenberg as a university town. In addition to being the professor of Bible there, he was also the main preacher in one of the two churches there in the city church. There's a castle church. That's where he nails up the theses. That's kind of the elector's private church. And then there's the city church where the people would go for their services. And that's where Luther was assigned to preach. And that was one of his real gifts. He was a gifted preacher. And his sermons, there are tons and tons of Luther sermons out there, and they're actually pretty brilliant.
Mm-hmm. Now, what is he teaching and studying while he's at Wittenberg? Is there a specific thing, or is he just assigned Bible, go from Genesis to Revelation, go?
Yeah, no, he teaches Bible, and so that's what his academic portfolio is to teach the Bible. And I don't know if there's a set curriculum. There's not a particular order. He begins with the Psalms. That's his first course of study. The one that's really important is when he lectures on Paul's epistle to the Romans. And he does that before the 95 Theses. And I can't remember the specific date, 1515 perhaps, somewhere around there. And according to his later recollection, it is the teaching of the beginning of the book of Romans that really starts to open his eyes to justification by faith. And so when he is teaching through Romans 1:17, says the just man, the righteous man shall live by faith, he later says that passage was what caused me to rethink how God relates to sinners. And as a teacher, right, one of the things that teachers all know is that having to teach something makes you learn it yourself in a deeper way. And I think having to teach through St. Paul helped Luther to learn more about St. Paul and to reflect on what St. Paul was saying and to develop his big idea, which is justification by faith.
Now, how is this really challenging the notion of grace at the time? This gets to the big issue of indulgences. So we're talking 1515, 1516, leading up to the big nailing of the 95 Theses in 1517. What's the intellectual ferment at this time?
The truth is it doesn't at this point really have much of an impact because Luther, like I said, is kind of in a backwards university and he's not a noteworthy guy. And the idea of justification by faith is not an unprecedented one. The implications of justification by faith that Luther's going to draw out are going to be problematic. And the big implication is if we are justified by faith, right, if we do not have to do things in order to merit God's grace, then what's the role of the church in that? What's the role of the sacraments? What's the role of good works in all those things? And saying that we're justified by faith, not through anything we've done, opens up questions about all of those things, and particularly about the sacramental system. And that's what gets Luther into trouble, as it were, once things come to light, is Luther says, yeah, if we're justified by faith, that whole system of sacramental penance, that's not necessary, right? That idea that you need to deny yourself by becoming a monk and that's somehow valuable to God, that's not necessary. And that kind of hits the church not just theologically, but also pragmatically, because there's a lot of money in that. And so that's what really gets Luther into trouble is taking the next step and saying, yeah, if we're justified by faith, then these systems, these structures that the church is vested in, maybe they're not as significant as the church wants us to think they are.
Now, this is a guy, he's at a backwater university, and who cares what this guy says? It turns out that he's a pretty popular professor. And yeah. He can mobilize a lot of people. One of the things I found reading your book is that there's a bunch of writings, memoirs or memos from discussions with other people called Table Talk. Well, explain what Table Talk is.
Yeah, the Table Talk is really interesting. And from the perspective of a historian, it's a super interesting and super problematic source for Luther's life. What happened is, late in Luther's life, he was a teacher, a professor at the university, and the custom at Wittenberg, and I think at most universities at that time, was for the students to board with the professors. And what Luther and his family did was they would let out some rooms. He actually owned, or he lived in, the former monastery, so he had tons of space. And so he let out these rooms to students, so they would live with him. And they would have dinner together. And so Luther would kind of preside over dinner with these students and retainers of his family, and his wife was there. And he told great stories. And the students would ask him questions. And in that kind of informal atmosphere, he would go off on things. And before long, the students started to take notes on these things. They would write down what Luther said, and they would preserve them. And those student notes have come down to us as the Table Talk. What you have in the Table Talk is a kind of an unvarnished view of what Luther's dinner table was like, right? I mean, he doesn't hold back. It's not like his published works where he might have edited them and tried to be careful, although I'm not sure how much editing Luther even did on his published works, but this is a significantly unedited Luther. And it's also, you know, filtered through the fact that this is what his students' notes kind of say about him. So you have to take the Table Talk with a bit of a grain of salt. I always think of the Table Talk as if someone was trying to reconstruct my work based on the notes my students took in class. I'm not sure they would get it exactly right.
Right, they never do.
But they're super juicy, the Table Talk stuff. And of course, you know, they'll ask Luther about all sorts of interesting things, you know, about the Turks or about, you know, childbirth. He actually gives like advice on childbirth and when children should be weaned, and all kinds of bizarre things are in the Table Talk because his students ask him, and he's like, all right, I'll talk about that too. So yeah, the Table Talk is super interesting. And I actually think if you're interested in Luther, if you grab a copy of the Table Talk, you can get them fairly inexpensively. And it's a super interesting sense. It gives you a totally different sense of the man mm-hmm. than the scholarly writings.
He comes across as somewhat of a boisterous figure, right? In your face kind of guy.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. He didn't hold back. And I think maybe that's what his students liked, respected about him, perhaps, that they felt like he was shooting straight with them because he wasn't holding anything back.
Well, he doesn't hold anything back in October of 1517 when he decides to basically take it to the church and nail his 95 theses to the wall of the castle church. And first of all, a question here, actually two questions related. There is the myth of him nailing this the 95 thesis to the wall of a church, which supposedly is the way you set up a debate that you want to. It's like a bulletin board, essentially. There is some question whether he did that or not. There's lots of paintings of him doing that. So the question is, did he do it or not? And then also, why did he choose the castle church rather than the city church?
Yeah, there is a scholarly question about whether he actually nailed up the theses. So the backstory is that it was a fairly common scholarly habit in the 16th century for a professor who had a topic that he wanted to discuss, to write up a bunch of theses, to post them publicly, and to more or less say, hey, I'm gonna be talking about these, I'm gonna debate these theses, and students and the public can come and sort of listen and engage on these theses. So producing a list of theses and posting them would have been non-controversial for a professor, even on a controversial topic. That would have been a fairly typical thing for him to do. The question of whether he actually nailed them to the door is one that that came up, I think, in the 1960s, where a scholar says, well, there's not really any evidence that they actually were posted. He didn't have the disputation that the theses were supposed to be about never occurred. And the only record of him actually posting them came from sometime after the fact. So there's a question about whether he did post them. I don't know whether that's significant or not. He clearly wrote them. And at the time, even if he didn't post them, he did send them to some important figures. Most notably, he sent them to the Archbishop of Mainz, Albrecht, who was the sort of the lead bishop in Germany. And so he sent a copy to Albrecht with a cover letter. So he does write them and he does publicize them. He doesn't have the disputation that they were supposed to be on. And had he nailed them to the door of the castle church, I mean, the story of he nails them on October the 31st My students always want to celebrate Halloween, and I say, no, we're going to celebrate Reformation Day, nail something to the door. That would have been the day before All Saints Day, which would have been a festival day in the church, and he would have been able to expect that people would have seen them. That's why he would have put them there. And so he nails those suckers up. He may or may not have nailed them up. He publicizes his thought. And I think Luther at this point, right, October of 1517, he thinks this is going to be just a typical scholarly thing, right? Like if a professor nowadays was to publish a scholarly article in the annals of whatever it is, right? But what he didn't know at the time was that his objection to indulgences was materially affecting both his bishop, Albrecht of Mainz, was wrapped up in this indulgence, and the papacy itself was wrapped up in peddling this indulgence. And so by raising questions about this indulgence, he inadvertently sort of undermined the position of two leading church officials that had a vested interest in having that indulgence go forward. And that's what propels him into the spotlight.
Well, propel him into the spotlight and tell us what happens after October 31st, 1517, the next 2 or 3 years or so, and more specifically, how Luther's personality shapes a lot of what goes on during this.
Yeah, so Luther gets called to task on indulgence. Actually, I mean, the first thing to mention is because of the printing press, and because apparently the 95 Theses were published with or without Luther's knowledge and consent. I think Luther sort of disclaimed any knowledge. I'm not sure if he was aware of it or not. But they were published and made public and translated into German and made public. So Luther's criticism of indulgences was not contained to the scholarly world, as it were. And indulgences were controversial, and there were a lot of people that thought indulgences were a problem. Erasmus was one, right? Because indulgences, I don't know if we've defined an indulgence yet.
So go ahead and tell us what indulgence is.
So an indulgence is, it is a certificate. It's granted by the church that gets you out of penance for your sin. Sometimes people shorthand the indulgences as like buying forgiveness for sins, and it's a little more technical than that. But the church would basically say, all right, if you've committed a sin, right, repent of your sin, but instead of doing the penance for your sin, right, we'll sell you this indulgence that you can do that. And the indulgence sales eventually sort of really blossom because it's super convenient for the church as a money-making, as fundraiser, right, because people want to get out of penance, right? And if I can either go on a pilgrimage to Jerusalem or pay some money, I'm going to buy the indulgence. And it's popular for a segment of the population because it's easy, right? I mean, instead of actually repenting of my sins, I'll shell out some money and I'll be assured of my eternal reward. And Luther looks at this and he says, especially now that he's starting to think about justification by faith, right? He says, God saves you without you having to do stuff. He says, that's crazy, right? And he points out that this is potentially corrupt, right? I mean, why is the Pope asking for money to grant people these indulgences? Why doesn't he do it because he loves them? Why doesn't he do it because he's like the Pope, for Pete's sake, right? Shouldn't the Pope, you know, do this without raising money for it? So it's dead set against what Luther is talking about. And it's also, theologically controversial, right? Because the theologians are asking questions like, well, does the Pope have the power, right? How does the Pope have the power to remit penance for money, right? How does that even work? So Luther hits a nerve, and when that kind of goes public, a lot of people are like, yeah, that's the kind of talk that we're... So he gains a lot of support from the literate public, from the sort of noble class in Germany that doesn't like to see indulgence money going to Rome. So he gets a lot of support from that. And when it's pointed out to the Pope and to Archbishop Albrecht, both of whom were deeply involved in this indulgence and were, you know, they had a vested financial interest in it, they see Luther as a threat. And so the Pope sets up an inquiry and sets up a commission to investigate whether Luther is orthodox, and they basically try and undermine Luther's position in order to continue their the indulgence sales. So he eventually gets called to Worms to defend himself. The famous Diet of Worms, the Pope and the Emperor at that point say, "All right, we've decided this is not appropriate teaching." And he defies the church and says, "Well, no, I can't recant this teaching.
Here I stand."
That's right. I can do no other,
is what he says. And one can almost see that in his kind of personality, his boisterous, bullheaded personality, and that really sets off the Reformation. We mentioned the Diet of Worms, which is probably one of the worst historical titles of anything, because you teach this to kids and they're thinking you've got your face in dirt. And,
isn't it great? So, I used to bring in bowls of gummy worms when I taught this. Kind of a mnemonic device.
What is a diet exactly?
So a diet is the regular meeting of the estates of the German Empire. So the Holy Roman Empire was this odd political assemblage that has an emperor, but the emperor isn't all powerful. The emperor is elected, and the emperor is checked by the power of all these nobles. And the nobles would meet periodically. I don't know if it was annually, but they would meet periodically in these things called diets. And the diet is held at a different city each time. And so at this point in 1520 or 1521, it was held at the city of Worms, which is in English spelled the same as Worms, the little critter that goes in. So it looks like Diet of Worms, like you're eating worms, but it's actually the meeting of the German nobles that happened in the city of Worms.
So, following on with how the Reformation rolls on, and we've talked to Steve Pfaff on a previous podcast of how this the socioeconomic and cultural factors actually influence the spread of the Reformation, I want to ask you about how Luther views himself. Luther is one of these figures that actually lasts past his big historical mark on society. He's still alive for another about 20, 25 years or so. And he gets a chance to look back and say, "Whoa, 25 years ago I did that? Really?" How does he look back at his role as a reformer and his role in history?
Yeah, and that's super interesting. A lot of stories of Luther kind of end with the break with the church, and he does. He lives for 20 more years after that. I think Luther sees himself as a kind of prophet, or he comes to see himself as a kind of prophet. For much of his early ministry in the 1520s, he expected that he would be martyred for the cause, and he wasn't. He died of most natural causes eventually, but he lived in this kind of expectation that he would eventually be martyred. He was always, for all of his life, he was an outlaw, and he was excommunicate from the church, which meant that he couldn't travel very freely. He could only go places where he knew that the local government would protect him. So he tended to see himself as kind of an Old Testament prophet figure, right? The guy that's preaching the truth, that's preaching the word of God, but to a people that doesn't want to hear it. And he saw himself as being under the threat of martyrdom his whole life.
So in terms of the rest of his life, how does he live out those last 20 years? I mean, he's seeing himself as a martyr and outlaw. He can't travel where he gets married.
He does, yeah. And that's a super interesting story. Luther, he starts in, so the Diet of Worms is 1521. His 95 Theses is 1517. And starting in about 1520, he begins to write that monastic vows, right, this vow of celibacy that he had taken as a monk. He says those shouldn't be binding. And he begins to write that priests ought to be able to marry. And his justification is fairly straightforward. He says, well, people have sexual needs, and it's unreasonable to expect people to simply deny themselves those. He says that kind of asceticism, that kind of self-denial doesn't help anybody. It doesn't make you more holy, and it only causes problems. So he says priests should be able to marry. So relatively early. And he encourages his students who are going to the ministry to get married. He even plays matchmaker with some of them and helps get them set up with women. But he himself doesn't get married. And he says, well, I don't really know if I need to get married. Part of it is because he expected to be martyred. Part of it is because he's in his 40s at this point, and he doesn't really think that he's marriageable. He's developed bachelor habits. But he does eventually marry, and his wife is a former nun, Katerina von Bora, who had escaped from her monastery with Luther's help, along with a number of other nuns, six or seven of them. And these women had been largely in the monastery, not due to their own will, right? They hadn't chosen, like, I'm going to go become a nun, right? It was either because their families couldn't afford to care for them or some other. So they escaped with Luther's collusion. So Luther knew the guy that delivered fish to the nuns, and he colluded with him to sneak the nuns out of their monastery. And they all came back to Wittenberg looking for help. And Luther tries to set them all up with husbands, these former nuns, because there really isn't a role for an unmarried woman in 16th century Germany. And so in order to set them up in society, he looks for wives for them. And he manages to marry, I think, most of them off, except for Katie, his wife. And he tries to set her up with a couple of people. He tries to set her up with one of his former students, and she says she doesn't like him. She's like, oh, he's a jerk. I don't want to marry this guy. And so refuses that, which I think speaks something of Katie Luther's character, right? I mean, as a woman in the 16th century to sort of be, you know, I'm not going to do that, right? And apparently one of Luther's associates, a guy named Nicholas Amsdorf, is asking her, he says, well, why aren't you marrying this guy that Luther wants to set up? And she says to Amsdorf, she says, well, I don't want to marry that guy, but if Luther is interested, I'd marry Luther. And this gets back to Luther, and he's like, oh, well, okay. And so he ends up marrying Katie, and he marries quite suddenly. One of his close friends, Philip Melanchthon, doesn't get invited to the wedding. No one was at the wedding. It was Luther and Katie and the preacher and one witness. And Melanchthon doesn't get invited to the wedding, and he's pissed. He's like, why'd you do that, right? And he thinks it's going to affect Luther's ministry. So the marriage was sudden and unexpected. He justifies it. He writes a letter that says, well, I married for a couple of reasons. He said, I married because my parents want grandchildren, and I think it's reasonable that they have grandchildren. And he says, well, I married because I've been telling preachers that they need to marry. I've been telling pastors they need to get married, and so I should set a good example. And he said his third reason was, and I got married because I think it would piss off the Pope, and I like that idea. And so none of it was about, wow, I fell in love and I saw her and it was love at first sight, right? And I think he recognizes that he marries out of sort of pragmatic reasons, but the marriage turns out to be an incredibly affectionate one, a loving one. And the correspondence that we have between Luther and Katie is warm and affectionate. And they clearly adore one another very much. She was the right woman for him. I mean, they were both stubborn as heck. And that probably, you know, put them together pretty well. And ultimately, Luther, when he knew he was dying, he wrote his will and made Katie the executor and of the will and the guardian of the minor children, which was actually not legal in Germany at the point. There had to be a male executor and a male guardian for children. And Luther's like, no, none of the men can stand up to Katie. She can handle it. And that, I think, illustrates his esteem for her. Of course, it didn't stand up in court, and the court said, no, we're going to appoint men to be guardians anyhow. But it shows some of how that relationship developed.
Interesting. An outlaw all the way through till the end of his life, breaking every rule that comes about to some extent.
And I think he did not see himself as an outlaw breaking laws for the sake of breaking laws, but I think Luther had one big idea, and that's that we're free under grace. And so we can't, you know, these authorities don't have purchase on us spiritually, and that gave him the freedom to, or that allowed him to be defiant when he thought that the rules were silly. So I don't think he was defiant for the sake of being defiant, but I think he developed this way of being able to say, that's a dumb law, right? I'm not gonna go by that.
Talking about big ideas, one of the things that I always like to ask my guest at the end of the interview is that scholarship is a process. You learn in the process. You don't have an idea and then just write it on paper. You have an idea, you start to write it, you start to reformulate it, you learn a lot of things. Anything that you learned through the process of studying Luther and writing this book?
Yeah. One of the things that was cemented in my mind by studying Luther is how sacramental Luther was. Luther initiates Protestantism, which tends to be an anti-sacramental kind of church. And some of what some of the outgrowths of Luther's ideas kind of play into anti-sacramentalism. But Luther himself thought that the sacraments were vital, the reality of the sacraments. And he put it sort of like this. He says, we are saved by grace, right? God saves us by grace. We don't have to do anything, but God gives us as tangible, embodied creatures, tangible, embodied ways for us to experience that grace. And because we're physical creatures, we need physical tokens like the Eucharist, like baptism. And so Luther, to the end of his life, and this is what sets him apart from all the other Protestant reformers, he was a strong advocate of the real presence of Christ in the Eucharist, and he was a strong advocate of the fact that the sacraments are not just symbols, but they do something. These are real things that God has initiated and has given to us as embodied creatures in order that we can have the assurance of God's grace. And that struck me both because I think that's a really good piece of theology. I mean, I am on board with Luther on this. But it also struck me because I think even most Lutherans in 2016, 2017 are not particularly affectionate for the sacraments. So that's the big thing that stood out. And it's one that doesn't often get a lot of play with Luther because Luther gets lumped in with other Protestants like Calvin, who have a very different take on what the sacraments are, what they're for.
Let me finish up with this final question. You're writing a dissertation, and the dissertation title is called Christopher Dawson and the Protestant Reformation. Give us a real quick flavor for what you're taking out of your studies of Luther and Protestantism and the Protestant Reformation and applying it to Christopher Dawson. First of all, who is he and why does this matter?
Yeah, well, my doctoral work is on kind of the big picture impact of the Reformation, and it's working on the question of how are the changes that happened in the 16th century religiously, how do they impact the world that we live in now? Specifically, we live in a secularized society, and especially in the United States, to a lesser extent in Europe, we live in an oddly secularized society that's got these kind of religious underpinnings, these religious foundations that we don't often recognize, and we try and ignore, and we try and overlay with this odd sort of secularism. And one of the things that Christopher Dawson does is he identifies that some of that modern secularism, some of that condition that we're in today, can draw its intellectual heritage back to the changes that were made in the Protestant Reformation. And Dawson is a Catholic historian from the early part of the 20th century, and so his analysis is critical of the Reformation to an extent, although Dawson is not. Dawson says that the Reformation was a necessary movement. It was important as a reform movement, but in a sense, it threw some of the baby out with the bathwater and contributed to things like the sort of rampant consumer capitalism that we see today, and it contributed to things like the pluralistic religious atmosphere in which we inhabit, where no one can lay claim to any transcendent reality that is binding on anyone else. And so that's the nature of my work, and it's sort of tangentially connected to my work on Luther. But it's really about the impact of what Luther did. And I think Luther would have not intended for these kind of long-term consequences. Luther sort of stumbled along. He was, I wanted to call the book The Accidental Reformer, because I think Luther sort of stumbled into his reform. He just had this idea, and then he sort of followed it along where it led. The publisher gave it this sort of, you know, normal title.
Yeah. All publishers do.
But I think Luther, you know, looking at today, Luther would have said, wow, I didn't really see that coming out of what he did. So that's where my doctoral work is.
Well, we're going to have to keep track on how you're progressing on that dissertation. And when you finish that off, we'll have you back on talking about the impact of the Protestant Reformation through the eyes of Christopher Dawson and yourself.
It would be a pleasure.
My guest today has been Rob Sorensen. Rob, thanks for being on Research on Religion.
It is my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.